All right, everyone. Good evening. Good evening. We're going to start the session, and you've come to the session. Was Avraham the first jihadist? So, actually, in the best traditions of Kalam, I hope I'm going to start with my conclusion, and I'm going to work backwards. So I just need my mad commands to go ahead. So I will say to you, yes, I think he was a jihadist, and I think he failed ultimately his test, and I think. Ultimately, as I'll show with sources, he did not end up being God's favoured son after all. That's going to be my conclusion. Now we have to get
there. We can go now, can we?
Well, I give that as a taste because people do decide to go early. At least they've got the conclusion, so they can be quite content. All right, so I'm going to give you some of the sheets. I want to be interactive, so feel free to challenge me.
Thank you.
I have no problem being challenged. In fact, I like being challenged. If I achieve anything, if it gets you thinking, that's a good thing in itself. You don't have to agree with me. You may fundamentally disagree with me. Fundamental being quite an operative word in this context. And so, before we get into the before we get into some of the texts I'm going to use, and my case will be quite straightforward. I'll leave some at the back. I think before we get into the details, some of them, obviously we need to define our terms. So what is a jihad, or what is a jihadist? How would we define that? Well, I've... Holy war. Any other?
Specifically Muslim
war.
Isn't it to overcome something? Somebody was to try to overcome a struggle.
A struggle, some form of struggle. Okay. But both of those ideas have actually been incorporated in the definition that I've got here, which I've got an online dictionary, and it says it's a noun. A jihad is a holy war undertaken as a sacred duty by Muslims. And secondly, any vigorous emotional crusade for an idea or principle, which is more generic. So that's our understanding of what that means. Now, if we look at Avraham himself, we know from early on he's known as Avraham Ha'ivri, the Hebrew, right? But literally means the other sider. That's who it is. And at least you've got the conclusion. There you are. All right, so anyway, Avraham the Ivri, literally the other sider. And also, we look a little further on, it says, no longer shall you be called Avraham. This is when God actually names him. You shall become Avraham, for I have set you up as a father of a multitude of nations. And that's quite interesting, with a multitude of nations. The nations being, yes?
Wait, why was Abraham called Avraham?
Why was he called? Ha'ivri. Well, that's a great point. You've led me on to the next point, because it says in a Midrash, it says Genesis Rabbah, it says Rabbi Yehuda said, the whole world stood on one side of the Euphrates River, whilst Avraham stood on the other. So he is a man of separation, right? He basically saw the world in a very different way to everybody else. And we'll see in a moment some other sources which perhaps firm up what that means in practical terms. Okay? But thank you. So let's take, there's two sort of key elements I'm going to take as part of my arguments here. One is the issue of idolatry, and the other one is to do with the most famous or infamous incident that affected Avraham, which is the Akedah. I think that many people struggle with and have the most difficulty with, and it will form central to some of the argument that I make. All right? So what I thought I'd bring in here is to do with this. We start with idolatry. We've got the Islamic State and the decimation of the Mosul Museum. This is quite a recent source. Earlier this year, it was quite famous in the news, and indeed, there's been a number of similar incidents subsequently. And so this is from an article in The Guardian, and it's titled, "Is ISIS Fighters Destroy Ancient Artifacts at Mosul Museum?" So it says here, Islamic State militants ransacked Mosul Central Museum, destroying priceless artifacts that are thousands of years old, in the group's latest rampage, which threatens to upend millennia of coexistence in the Middle East. The destruction of statues and artifacts that date from the Assyrian and Akkadian empires, revealed in a video published by ISIS, which begins with the Quranic verse on idol worship. An ISIS representative speaks to camera, condemning Assyrians and Akkadians as polytheists, justifying the destruction of the artifacts and statues. The man describes the Prophet Muhammad's destruction of idols in Mecca as an example. These statues and idols, these artifacts, if God has ordered its removal, they become worthless to us, even if they're worth billions of dollars, the man said. So quite a strong condemnation, seeing it as idolatry. Now, were you troubled? Yes.
Surely it's only idolatry if you worship it.
Ah, well, that may indeed be a debatable question. But I want to take it directly to a source in Bereshit Rabbah. And it's a famous midrash, which you may all be familiar with. And this is one about Abraham and the idols. And it's got, Rabbi Akiva relates, Terah was an idol manufacturer who once went to our nephew's son, Avraham, in charge of the store. A man walked in and wished to buy an idol. Avraham asked him how old he was, and the man responded, 50. Avraham said, you're 50 years old, and yet you want to worship a day-old statue. At this point, the man left ashamed. Later, a woman walked into the store and wanted to make an offering to the idols. So Avraham took a stick, smashed the idols, and placed the stick in the hand of the largest idol. When Terah returned, he asked Avraham what had happened to all the idols. Avraham told them that a woman had come in to make an offering to the idols. The idols argued about which one should eat the offering first. Then the largest idol took the stick and smashed the other idols. Terah responded by saying, that is nonsense. They're only statues and have no knowledge. Whereupon Avraham responded by saying, you accept they have no knowledge, yet you worship them. Now, obviously, the question is, does he really worship them, or is he just a businessman trying to make money out of it? It's a question. But nonetheless, our chap who earlier in the article from The Guardian was saying Muhammad's destruction is in Mecca, he could take an earlier source. He could go to Avraham here. And Avraham is a father of a multitude of nations. He isn't just Avraham Avinu, father of the Jews. He's father of the Christians and father of the Muslims as well. Right? He's a father of three faiths. Yes?
But how could you be a jihadist when jihadist specifies in Muslim when he was Jewish?
Well, he wasn't Jewish. He wasn't Jewish. Yeah, we call him Avraham Avinu, and as I will say later on, I don't believe he was ultimately chosen by God to get the Torah, and we know that isn't the case. We know he was, we say he's the first Jew, but there was no Torah at that stage, particularly, although some argue that the forefathers were keeping the Torah. They had that argument before it was actually given, and that is accepted by some in the certain sources or certain traditions hold that view. But clearly, there is a sense that he wasn't just a father of the Jews. He's clearly a father of the Christians, and indeed, the Muslims believe that when Abraham sacrificed his son, it was Ishmael that he sacrificed rather than Isaac. So they would hold very strongly he's their father.
But also, then you could say we are called Bnei Yisrael, which is the other name for Yaakov, not
yeah,
for Abraham.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're not Bnei Abraham, we're Bnei Yisrael.
Yeah. But having said all of that, there is strong sources within the Torah and in the Talmud opposing idolatry. And this certainly comes later than Avraham. And indeed, we only have to go to the second of the Ten Commandments, which can be traced to Shemot. And it says here, do not have any other gods before me. Do not represent such gods by a carved statue or a picture of anything in the heavens above or on the earth below, in the water below the land. Do not bow down to such gods or worship them. I am the Lord your God, a God who demands exclusive worship. Where my enemies are concerned, I keep in mind the sin of the fathers to their descendants to the third and fourth generation. So quite a strong view on idolatry or any form of representation in that sense. And the Mishnah takes that somewhat further. In Avodah Zarah, it says, if one finds vessels with a drawing upon it of the sun or a drawing of the moon or a drawing of a dragon, he should bring them to the Dead Sea to dispose of them. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, those vessels which are treated with honour are forbidden. Those vessels which are treated disrespectfully are permitted. Rabbi Yossi says, one should grind the vessel with the drawing and dispense it in the wind or cast it into the sea. The sages said to him, even that might become fertiliser, as it's said, and he quotes it in Devarim, and let nothing of the condemned cling to your hand. Quite a strong rejection of any form of idolatry, and indeed, I know a friend of mine once was sitting shiva sadly for his father, and he had on the wall, on his bookshelf, some wooden carvings of animals. And his family, he's got a brother who's quite strong, Haredi, he's given there, and obviously they came and they saw these idols, and they said, they're idols on the wall, they were furious of him, get those out of the room. They saw them as representations of this particular going against this command, and they were quite furious with him. So there are many who hold that any form of representation, whether it's literally worshipped, as you said, Stephen, or not, the census of representation means it could be used for worship or could have been produced by people who were worshipping, and therefore on that basis should not have any representation at all. And we are have a very strict view in our synagogues. We don't have any carvings on the, or in the wall at all or anything like that. It's very plain. And there is this concern about any form of representation, however well intended, that it could be misused in that way.
If it's a representation for the purpose of art, so obviously not in the synagogue, because it's a house of worship, house of prayer, a house of learning, I understand that, but if there's an artist, a sculptor, or whatever, and they produce a representation, but it's purely for art purposes and not for prayer or idolatry purposes, are you saying that the same applies for that?
Some take a very strict and stringent view, would say yes, they would. They have no representation because they say it is a literal interpretation or use of God in a way, or trying to, or something which could be perceived as another form of godliness, and therefore you cannot have it. So there are strict views of that. Others would take a more lenient view, correct. But there are those who do hold that any form of representation would fit into that category, yes.
So if you went into a holy house or home, so you find like no representations of
animals or something? No. They might have pictures of rabbis on the wall.
Yeah, you will. you'll find lots of pictures of the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
That's
a special case.
That's in the Lubavitch households, but if you go to any sort of Haredi person who's not Hasidic, they will have pictures of rabbis, you know, and they would argue that's not the representation. They are the just holy people that they look up to, but you're right, it could be, you could see it in that way. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is certainly image and representation is something which is seen very strongly frowned upon in certainly Jewish circles. But indeed, what I'm saying here, my case against with this one, is that Avraham himself, you know, could say was the progenitor of this particular approach. And really, when they're smashing up idols, you know, for whatever reason, you might say they're pieces of art and history, but you could say there's a very strong tradition within our own which says they are not right and perhaps they should be destroyed. Yeah.
So, already you go to an art gallery? So.
Possibly not. In fact, many of them wouldn't. And they wouldn't go in it necessarily because if you say the National Gallery, there's lots of crucifixes in there and images are from Christian. And
what if it was just like a Jewish art? Would they go in there?
Potentially. Art in itself, pictures, depending if it was of scenery and things like that, yes. There's less of a problem in those sorts of scenery, because you picture, you know, that's one thing. But when you're talking about sorts of images in some ways, then they are quite cautious about that.
So would they accept just plain pictures of it, or could they have like it in the background, or would they accept like maybe a meadow with an animal in the
middle? Yeah, they may well, but of course you won't find too many in Haredi households. You won't find too many paintings on the wall. That's not something that would be favoured. But my point being here, there is a tradition within ourselves which goes back to Avraham. And my point being, Avraham is the father of a multitude of nations. It states it in the text. He isn't just the father of the Jews. He's the father of the Christians, and he's certainly the father of the Muslims too. Okay. I want to take a source from Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, who is a Haredi writer, thinker, quite a significant figure of the 20th century. And this is what he says. Now, we're going to read the words and just put aside what he's talking about Judaism and see if you can apply it to Muslims too, or anybody, any form of... So it says, "We must imagine the courage necessary for Avraham to get up and stand against his father, his whole family, and indeed the entire world, in order to fight for the truth of God's oneness. We all know how difficult it is to swim against the stream of society, even in an environment that is slightly opposed to our beliefs. How much more so for a single individual submerged in a society that is completely against him? What courage Avraham must have had! This is nothing but utter stubbornness to do good, a decision not to give up under any circumstance. On account of this strength, Avraham merited to receive the covenant, a promise that will never be broken, that his children would endure forever."
I think think it could apply to many situations, people in society standing up against something, going against the norm, and having courage to do it. So yeah, it could
easily apply in this context, I would suggest, to anyone. And he's, as I say, if he's the father of a multitude of nations, I could quote, if I was I'm standing against society. Society's broken values. Here I am, and I have a great source. Even Rabbi Eliyahu Tesla could be quoted by ISIS. There we are. Stand up against the decadence of the world.
Your mate Corbyn's been doing it all his life.
Thank you very much. Not my mate, yes. No. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
So, like, you could find this in any different, diverse society. So it could apply to everything.
It could apply to many things. He's clearly raising it as a context of this man who stood aside, the Ivri, right? The Ivri stood on the other side, separated, and it's something to be admired by what he's done, right? Yes.
If someone else had written it, would he accept it and embrace it as something which could have applied to the religion of Judaism?
If somebody other than Eliyahu Tesla had written it, I suspect he probably would have done because it wasn't a Jewish source. But my point being, if you take away who wrote it, and take away that it's about obviously it's about Avraham, as I say, it's the father of multitudes, it could quite easily apply to the argument of some form of jihad, some form of principle, stepping aside and making a stance, which is indeed what it is. I mean, the argument again, we have this idea of jihad being destruction. But as I said, it says that any vigorous emotional crusade for an idea or principle. That's the broadest sense.
You could say Martin Luther King or something.
Sorry?
You could say on a more peaceful level, so Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Standing up against.
Yes, it could do it. So it's a jihad is basically making a stance and standing firm on that position. It doesn't necessarily in itself necessarily mean violence, although the example I've taken here, the destruction of idols, is clearly something directly, I think, is directly relevant. In this way, you can agree, disagree with me. It's fine.
It says it's a discourse on Passover. So, is there some parallel with Moses standing up and going against the tide, so to speak, and leading the Jews out of slavery? I mean, you know, is that a kind of that
it could
right?
be? I mean, I'd need to look at further at the extent of what he's saying in this one, but I pulled it out of him, but mainly because of what he's saying about Avraham itself specifically. Okay. But you're absolutely correct. It could be used in that context. All right. So look, I want to move us to the key point, which is about the ultimate test, which at the Akedah, which I think troubles most people. Are many people in this room troubled by the Akedah?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's look at this, and I will say this is where I'm going to bring my evidence against Avraham. Right. But anyway, 10 tests. Our father Avraham was tested and he withstood them all. This is a claim which is made in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, in order to make known how great our father Avraham's love for God was. Right? So this is this idea of 10 actual tests that Avraham is considered to have taken. Now, what those 10 tests are is actually a debatable point. There is actually no, it doesn't state it specifically in the Ethics of the Fathers. The Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, is actually a tractate of the Talmud. It's one where there's no actual Gemara, which is commentary, on Mishnah. It's pure Mishnah, right? So it's statements, and in this case, they don't in any way elaborate. So it's left to commentators to come up with what they believe these 10 tests are. And surprise, surprise, they don't happen to agree on what they are. There are actually quite some differences in there. There are some which we might consider to be things that you might think of some of the tests, such as the commandment to discard Hagar, his wife, and also his son Ishmael. Yeah, circumcision of himself is one which is in there. There are differences. Some put in some of the midrashim, such as this idea that Avraham was cast into a fiery furnace, which is a tautology, but thrown into a furnace, which is most fiery furnaces being fiery, by Nimrod. There's this idea. And that's a midrash. It's not actually a text, and that's shared by some commentators. Maimonides himself doesn't go down the Midrashic route. He keeps to everything that is in the actual written Torah in that way. But they all tend to agree upon one of those 10 tests, which is, as we see here, Avraham told by God to sacrifice Isaac upon an altar, right? Or Yitzhak. And that's agreed by Rashi, Maimonides, and Avadia of Botanura. So that is agreed. And we know the actual text itself. It's quite the chilling text which we see in Bereishis. And it's after the treaty of Bathsheba with Abimelech, God tested Avraham. Avraham, he said, yes, take your son, your only one you love, Yitzhak, and go away to the Moriah area. bringing up as an all burned offering on one of the mountains that I will designate unto you. Now, it's actually, the text, it says an oleh, right? An oleh is the actual description. And that can mean sacrifice. It can also mean bring him up. Bring him up, which doesn't necessarily mean sacrifice. It means rise him up, elevate him in this way. And the sages themselves, troubled as they are by this particular text, or not comfortable with the idea that he may have sacrificed. Some do go for this idea where the intention was never to sacrifice his son. The idea was to bring him up. But that is not the general reading or acceptance of the meaning of what took place. And as we know, Avram got up early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took his two men with him, along with his son Isaac, or Yitzhak. He cut wood for the offering and set out, heading for the place that God had designated. Avram reached out, took the slaughter knife to slit his son's throat. So it's generally considered that he was prepared to go through with this test, even though God promised him that he would have a nation separate to Ishmael, who was promised to be a nation to himself. He was promised that Isaac would grow up to be the father of another nation. And yet Avram had difficulty with this, and yet was asked to slaughter, and yet had this idea that it would happen. Yes, Rach.
With the idea of him being the father of many nations, the text itself, to me, seems to possibly sort of talk about a sort of struggle which he's trying to overcome here, where God's like, take your son, the one you love, and then he still hasn't made a decision,
yeah.
And he goes, you know, Isaac.
Yeah.
So he has to kind of be pushed into making that choice.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is sort of like, to this point, you know, that you're saying, like, in Abraham maybe failing, that, you know, when God says take your son, he clearly in his mind, to be horribly anthropomorphic, has an idea of who he wants to be sacrificed, and Abraham is kind of unsure of what God wants from him. So possibly that could add later to the idea of failure in his purpose.
I mean, he seems, if you're saying he wasn't so sure, he could have said very clearly, so, I mean, you're right, the sages talk about a struggle that he didn't want to, and God had to push him to the point of telling him exactly, take the time, which son are you talking about? The one you love. Well, I love them both. Which one? Yitzhak.
Your only one.
Your only one. And because that's the question, your only one, he's got two sons. Ishmael's his other son.
Because I learned this text at school, and my teacher said, the Russian's comments on your only one, because they're both the only one from the mother, Isaac's from
Yes.
And
yes, that's right, that's correct. So he had this internal struggle, but he was prepared. The bottom line is, he's prepared to go through with this sacrifice of his son. Now, the other point to bear in mind is, many critics of this, and certain religious critics, I'll come to you in a second, okay, why don't you say that Isaac himself was not some child, right, in the sense of an eight-year-old kid. It's basically that he was 37 years of age, okay? How do we know he's 37 years of age? Well, we know he's 37 in the sense that his mother gave birth to him when she was 90. And we know from the source which we will come to afterwards is that Sarah died, they say, immediately after the Ekeidah, and she was 127. So if we work out the mathematics, that's 37. So he wasn't some young kid who was going into it by a father, slapping him on there and saying, right, how old are you two? You're 12 and you're
11.
11, okay, fine. So you're a bit older than this idea, but nonetheless, 37 is a bit older than what you might think, yeah? It is. So there is a question, was it Yitzhak himself who was being tested? Because he was prepared to go through it. He could have taken his father and said, hey, what do you think you're doing? I'm not having that, yeah.
But Why did God want
Abraham
to kill his son?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. Why would a loving God ask Abraham to do it? Well, that is the question that has to be asked. Well, it's said to be one of the tests of Abraham, right? So the question is,
the test was, would he go through with something because of his faith in God? So if he was going to stand on the other side against all the rest of the world, that he was saying there's only one God, and that one God, it's easy to say, and it's easy to say, but to show his commitment.
Oh, okay.
But God knows that it's not going to happen.
He may well know, but I mean, Avram doesn't know it's not going to happen.
Except that, because there's lots of, as you say, there's lots of readings on it.
Yeah.
So one reading is that only someone like Abraham, who had that strength of faith, could actually go ahead with it, because it's the angel of death. So the angel comes to stop it.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment. Let's hold where we are at the moment.
Spoiler.
Sorry. Let's go back, because that's a central point, which I do want to come to as part of my evidence. Yes, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, if the angel hadn't come, would he have gone through it?
Well, it seems to be that he would.
Oh.
This is a debate. This is a debate. And indeed, actually, there are some Midrashim, and Midrashim being, for those who are not so clued, Midrashim are rabbinic texts which seek to give you further padding to a story. So the story of Abraham and the idols, which I mentioned earlier, is a midrash, right? It's not mentioned in the actual written Torah, but it's a story that many people are familiar with, or actually were brought up believing it is in the Torah. There are many of these stories about, again, with the fern being thrown. It's not actually in the text, right? It's actually something which is added to by the rabbis at certainly a much later period. But it's a story which is meant to say this is could have happened, maybe it might have happened, But it's really to give you an idea of the man and the period and the sorts of things he was facing. But that's clearly very much a case. So anyway, what was I going to say? Yes. So my question is, would he have gone through with it? There were some commentaries and some midrashim which actually say he did go through with it. Actually, he was sacrificed. The lad was sacrificed, and his ashes were on the altar. There's this idea which is actually said, not accepted by all, and certainly perhaps not by majority, but there are many which tend to say that that was actually, he went through and fulfilled the criteria, which then makes it a bit more problematic with then Isaac later on marrying, so it's a bit challenging in that sense, or that he was brought back to life. There is this idea he was brought back, which has its own problems in itself and connotation with that too. All right, so the question is, did he pass the test? Did he actually pass the test? So I'm going to say, I don't believe he did pass the test. I'm going to believe he actually failed the test. And I'm going to make my argument. This is my case. And we're going to see whether you agree with me or whether you disagree with me. All right? So number one, my first source I'm going to bring into this case and say, and that is the one about principle, Yahareg Ba'el Ya'avor. This is let him be killed rather than transgress. This is an actual commandment, and you may be familiar. It's from, the Talmud, Sanhedrin. And it's Rav Yochanan says, in the name of Rav Shimon ben Yed Hatzadik, it was decided by a vote in the loft of the house of Nitzizer in Lod, for all the sins in the Torah, if a person is told, transgress and you will not be killed, they should transgress and not be killed, except for idol worship, illicit sexual relations, and murder. So it's a clear sense that if you are commanded any of those three things, you are prepared to actually not go through with that. If someone tells you to murder someone, you're not prepared, you must actually say no. It's actually prohibited. And you must be prepared to die yourself rather than kill somebody else. Right? So that being the case, the challenge being, you may say, well, he was listening to God. God said him to kill his son. What's he doing? If that's a principle, and we know the Torah wasn't been given, so I know, Mr. Lindor, I know you're going to come in to me and say, the Torah wasn't yet given. What did you give him? But there's a principle that they were keeping this idea that they were keeping the principles of the Torah, and therefore when we have the final giving of the Torah, they were living with those.
I am going to come in.
Go on.
But a sacrifice to God on God's instruction isn't a murder.
A murder is when
you go to somebody, whether you like them or not, and say, and shove a knife in.
What's the difference?
That's a murder.
Well, hold on,
this
sorry.
Isn't a murder.
So God speaks to you, wakes tomorrow morning and says to you, it's Lindel, would you go out there and murder these people around you because they're all, people who don't keep my commandments? God has a direct communication with you. Is that acceptable?
I think I'd have had too many magic mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, but that's the issue. The fact it's God telling you to do something, how does that make it different or more acceptable? Because he has a direct communication. This is what the Islamics say. God's spoken to us. We're following the word of God and we're doing it. So what's wrong with that?
But it was different because it was... God, it was really God. It wasn't just a voice.
Well, how do you know it's not really God? How do you know what's spoken? They say they've got a direct relationship. But the point being, if it's you're saying you should do it, if God tells you do it, then you do it.
No, because we're not on that level.
Well,
you can't really say it's murdering, because murder wouldn't be your own idea, rather than it's someone who's forcing you, so like a little voice, like your conscience, actually. Because God could be maybe forming the conscience.
Okay, in your conscience of mind. But again, internationally,
that just following orders isn't an excuse.
Yes,
you've just justified anybody who served in a concentration camp. I was just following orders.
Yes.
If God wanted to murder someone, he wouldn't tell someone to murder him. Surely he would do it himself.
Well, that's a question. Well, I'm going to come back and I'll show you sources which I think backs up my argument that he fell. But go on. Yeah.
Against you, I feel really sorry arguing against you. I'd much rather argue against you on this one. But actually, again, like the Jews are sent to kill all these sort of armies on the way towards Israel, and then of course we're told to wipe out. And the name is Slimy, but well, everyone else clearly wants to kill them. So it's, we're told to wipe out Amalek. So we clearly can be used as vessels for sort of holy war, as
yeah.
it could be. But also the fact is that what we're saying is, you know, should you be punished for it or not? We're sort of blurring the lines between divine punishment and punishment due to the law of the land. And I think also we can't really put morality into this, because morality doesn't really exist so much in these ideas. When we talk about doing something good in the Torah, we're saying sort of like in line with what is divine or in line with what is the plan. When God looks at the earth and sees that it is good, it's, you know, it's going according to plan. Mm. It's going according to the way things should be. So murder is morality, immoral, we could say, but it doesn't have, morality doesn't have a place in this discussion.
Okay, well, we'll come and see. Sorry, you looked like bigger.
Well, imagine you're Abraham and you're up there and you're thinking, should I sacrifice him? Should I not sacrifice him?
Yep.
If you don't sacrifice him,
yes.
then God will come and God is likely to come and smite you for not following orders.
Yes.
If you do sacrifice him, because Abraham knows that Yitzhak must have children in order to be able to have a nation on that side, therefore Yitzhak can't just go and die. So he will either not die or will come back to life. And because of that, Abraham knows that if he goes and tries to sacrifice Yitzhak, it's not actually murder if he's coming back to life. It's attempted murder, but it's not actually
Okay, so I would suggest to you, you're putting in what you'd like to see, as you know, how the story plays out, or the promise. You know, maybe God was lying to him. Maybe he said you're going to live, maybe he changed his mind. Maybe that's not the case, yeah? So you can't, you know, this is a sense of trying to interpret or interpose another idea, which I think is difficult. He's been told to kill someone. And you're saying maybe God will kill him. Well, maybe you should say, fine, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this. You're asking me to kill this. I'm not prepared to do it. To kill me.
So you're saying he failed.
I'm saying he failed. I'm going to show evidence. I'll come into the sources. Okay, I'll let you take in the next source, which is going to trump the points you're making about listening to God's voice. Yes.
So this is kind of a question. So when he was up there to Abraham was up there to kill him, so you're kind of questioning
Okay. Well, let's take the one I'm going to show, which is this idea, should we have to listen to God's voice? We're going to look at Rabbi Eliezer, the story of Rabbi Eliezer and challenging the sages. And this is a famous story about the oven of Agni. Are some of you familiar with this story? Okay, so this is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, one of the key sages at the time of the Mishnah, period of the Mishnah. So we're talking around in the destruction of the Second Temple period. We're talking around the compilation of the Mishnah is around 200 CE. And we're talking about the, so he was a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So he lived in the aftermath around 70 CE. So around that period, the first, second centuries, okay, of the Common Era. And the story goes as follows. There was a certain oven that the sages differed over. There was a disagreement over whether it was considered to be clean or unclean, because certain earthenware can be, whether it could be actually cleaned or not cleaned, kashered or not kashered, okay? Rabbi Eliezer considered the oven to be like a building. Now, this Rabbi Eliezer, I need to just say, is a pretty significant sage. Yeah? He's not some you know, local community rabbi. He's one of the key rabbis of the generation, a significant sage in himself. And he's quite conservative in his thinking, conservative being a traditionalist, quite traditionalist in his thinking. Anyway, Rabbi Eliezer considered the oven to be like a building and held that it was not susceptible to impurity. His colleagues, however, considered it to be like an earthenware vessel, and thus they believe it could become impure. It was a heated discussion, and although Rabbi Eliezer supported his view with a wealth of arguments and proofs, other rabbis refused to change their minds, so it was him against the rest of them. Okay? On that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. Said he to them, "If the halakha agrees with me, let the carob tree prove it." Thereupon, a carob tree was torn 100 cubits out of its place. Others say it was 400 cubits. And they said, "No proof can be brought from a carob tree." Again, he said to them, if the halakha agrees with me, let the stream of water prove it. Whereupon a stream of water flowed backwards. And again they said, no proof can be brought from a stream of water. He urged, if the halakha agrees with me, let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it. This is the yeshiva building, whereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Rabbi Yehoshua rebuked them, saying, when scholars are engaged in a halakhic dispute, who are you to interfere? Hence, they did not fall in honour of Rabbi Yeshua, nor did they resume their upright in honour of Rabbi Eliezer. And they are still standing thus inclined. So the wall started caving in and stopped. Okay. Again, he said to them, if halakha agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven. Rabbi Eliezer stood up and said, so let it be decided from above. And God accepted his appeal. Without delay, he sent the prophet Elijah, who said to the sages, why are you fighting against Rabbi Eliezer? He's always right in his rulings. Rabbi Yeshua stood up and replied, it says in the Torah is not in heaven. The Torah was given to us by God at Mount Sinai, and in it we find a precept that the decision shall be made according to majority rule. Rabbi Nathan met Elijah and asked him, what did God, blessed be he, do in that hour? He laughed with joy. He replied, saying, my sons have defeated me, my sons have defeated me. It was said on that day that all objects which Rabbi Eliezer had declared clean were brought and burnt in fire. They then took a vote and excommunicated him. Now, the point, it's a very strange story. It's a very strange story. It is quite a famous story. But the point being, it's an argument whereby he brings in the voice of God, and the voice of God is rejected. And they're saying, the Torah is decided on earth. You gave us the Torah. Now, I accept the fact you're going to say it might be the Torah came afterwards. That's true. But the point, principle being, an argument with God, God himself, the direct voice of God, and God is told, go away, this is a decision between us on earth, not for you to interfere. So there is a clear case here of the sages being in dispute with God and telling him where to go, and God actually withdrawing. So the case of challenge is there. Yes, Rafi?
So the first thing I ask is, obviously this, of course, in the Talmud, and therefore, unlike the Torah, if you're going by the Orthodox view, not a divine document.
Not true. It is the oral tradition, which includes the Mishnah and the Talmud, are given equal weighting to the written Torah, because unlike, and it's a central point here, many people say the difference between Christianity and Judaism is the fact that, you know, we have the Old Testament, and it's just a matter of, like, it's Christianity without the trimmings, yeah? But that's not the case. Judaism cannot be understood just by reading the written Torah. Right, because this is a classic case when they talk about, it says they would try and argue that the Old Testament was replaced by a New Testament. Why? Because you have things like an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. We would say, well, that's a complete misreading of the text. You can't understand that reading of the text, because otherwise it would become quite a brutal document. We have the oral tradition, and in the Mishnah and the Talmud, it expands. That it means monetary compensation. If somebody takes out an eye, there's a monetary compensation. We don't end up everyone poking out each other's eyes. So the two have to be seen together as a package. They certainly are seen as central. The old tradition is seen as valuable as the written tradition.
So accepting that then, which I'm happy to do, could we not argue that in this case what we're actually seeing is that the principles of Judaism are almost based on heresy? Because we have the rabbis directly arguing with God, even when God says, no, this is correct and
yeah,
this is wrong. Not only do they not only do they argue against God and against what God wishes to happen, they then sort of throw out the person who was speaking the truth. In its essence, they're almost treating Rabbi Eliezer like Abraham may have been at the time.
Yes.
Speaking from God, but in here it seems to be punishment.
Take what Rafi said one stage further, they're actually saying they don't believe in God. Because if God says X and they say, no, no, God, go away, we don't believe in you being right,
yeah,
they're not believing in God.
No,
right?
Not at all.
No, the principle.
Not at all, Dad. Because what they're saying, no, because what they're saying, they're not saying that we don't believe in God. God by his own rules, said that you decide my majorities. Therefore, they're saying, God, these are the rules that you gave us.
Yes.
We're playing by them, then you shouldn't be interfering.
Yeah.
That's not saying that we don't believe in you, we're just playing by your own rules that you gave us.
If God sees fit to interfere, should they not at least...
He didn't see fit to interfere, he was called upon, and then he duly obliged. That's not interfering.
Right. But
this
is the point.
He's still coming to the island.
You can't ignore God.
You can't ignore God.
We have a family dispute going on in the
rules. By God's own rules, he's not part of the discussion.
Okay. Do you want to bring your point in? Yes.
So
Simon.
Simon's basically said what I was going to say.
Okay.
I was going to say that Hashem wrote the Torah, and he says that the discussions that whatever should be made upon earth, not in the,
right.
in the heavens. So Hashem would back off because he realized that they were only applying the one of the rules he had set.
Yeah.
And one of the interpretations is the reason why Eliezer gets punished in this scenario is he should have known better than to call on God. And he should have known better than to do that because he was so learned that he should have relied on his own his own ability to convince and not call on God to help him.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's a fair point. My point, what I'm seeking to bring you is my evidence, is a sense of the idea that you have to listen to everything of God is clearly, there's a key source in here of a key sage challenging God or trying to support, bring God as a support and being rejected by the rabbi and saying, you know, tell God to butt out. It's not his,
Yeah, that's one interpretation of it.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, and the other interpretation is saying God coming into it to remind everybody that actually he's only there because he was called on, but actually Rabbi Elias gets punished for that.
Yeah, there is, but it's about being formed on earth. I think the issue being, there's Torah from heaven, which is fine and in theoretical. We're talking about Torah in practice on earth, right? And that's the issue about how is it formed, how it's created. I was trying to bring a proof, which was the argument which is said about how can you challenge God. I'm saying there is a case here of God being challenged, being rejected. That's the point I'm making, but I'm going to use other sources. Yes.
But there is a case of God being challenged and the challenge is being absolutely smited.
Yeah.
If you think of the Tower of Babel, they were trying to build up a tower all the way up to the heavens such that they could challenge God.
Yes.
God was not happy with this and went and sort of got rid of that.
But he didn't. He didn't destroy them, though. The interesting thing about the Tower of Babel, he wiped out the flood, he wiped out the whole people, yeah? The Tower of Babel would have seeking to destroy God. He didn't do that. And the reason they say is, because when it came to trying, the reason the flood was wiped out was because people couldn't agree with one another. It was the whole society was anarchy, right? Whereas the destruction of seeking to destroy God, God said, only scattered them. And some of the commentaries say, it's because God could tolerate them discarding God as long as they could live at peace with one another. And that was the difference. The argument was that they had a central goal to destroy God, but at least they were unified. So that's the argument. Let's take another source. And this is, of course, about Avram challenging God. He said, don't challenge God. Well, he did challenge God when he had the issue for Sodom, right? God's going to destroy Sodom. God says, shall I hide from Avram what I'm going to do? Avram is about to become a great and mighty nation, and through him all the nations of the world will be blessed. I have given him special attention so that he will command his children and household after him, and they will keep God's way, doing charity and justice. God will then bring about for Avram everything he promised. God said, the outcry against Sodom is so great, and their sin is so very grave, I will descend and see. Have they done everything implied by the outcry that is coming before me? If not, I will know. Remember, this is when Avram is visited by these messengers. This is a few days after he's had his circumcision. These messengers are coming, and one of them says they are actually on a mission to go and destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, right? So it says the messengers turned from where they were and headed towards Sodom. And then Avraham was still standing before God, and he came forward and said, will you actually wipe out the innocent together with the guilty? And we then know there's this in dialogue. Will you wipe out if there are 50 good people? And God says, no, I won't. Well, what about if there's 40, if there's 30, and it goes on until there's 10? He has this argument with God. He clearly challenges God. And so therefore, it puts space to this idea that he's meek and he has to accept. He gets into a debate. Now, why didn't he say to God, what are you doing saying to me, my son? You want me to sacrifice the son? How can you do that? Why didn't he do that for his own son? Yes?
He's arguing because he's trying to find the good in every evil. There's always he's thinking on the positive, that there's always some good in every evil.
There's always some good, okay, that might be. But why is he not challenging God when it comes to his own son, who's prepared to challenge about these people he doesn't even know in Sodom? Yeah, his own very son, it's all right, we say he's 37, but it's still his son. He doesn't even say, God, yeah, okay, I'll go for my donkey, I'll go and sacrifice him. Doesn't challenge him. Yes?
They're different. God did not say to Abraham, go to Sodom and Gomorrah and go and kill them all. And God did not, and also on the other side, God did not say, I will go and kill your son, Isaac. So I think that this particular incident doesn't seem... Abraham is asking for all these people to be saved, it's God that God, he knows that God is, he can reason with God, but he is a different person. And if God comes up to him and tells him to do something, he can't say, oh, I don't actually want to do it.
He can. But I think he can.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if God had said to Abraham that he was going to sacrifice all the people, as sort of, well, would Abraham have then said, challenged it? Because he didn't.
So you're saying, because God was saying himself, God felt, Abraham said, okay, I can challenge you because you're going to do it. But if he's telling you to do it, he did challenge you.
No, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm saying that he was going to punish the people of Sodom, but he wanted Abraham to sacrifice his son.
That's right.
And it's the sacrifice which, therefore, he wasn't challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was quite prepared to do it.
Mm.
Okay, yes.
Because the two things, the purposes are very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So one is a sacrifice, which is an elevation, right? So it's, and the other one is God saying he's angry with another people. And he's not instructing Abraham to go and kill them.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying he's angry. And then Abraham is challenging God to say, well, didn't you tell me there's good in everyone? So
mm-hmm.
it's not quite the same thing. One is a punishment. And the other one is...
But he's still my point is, he's still prepared to challenge. Whatever he's saying, listen, he might have still gone ahead with the principle of the sacrifice of his son and said, I can understand it. But surely he had, we know for it, that he was going through this challenge. How can God ask me to sacrifice for someone who's promised my son will be a generation, a father of a people? Why did he say to God, okay, you want me to do this and you're telling me what to do it. I have to accept what you're doing, but please explain to me why. Please explain to me, I can't understand it. There's no evidence of that. Yeah.
To go against the idea of he doesn't challenge elevations, he goes to Israel where he's been told he's going to sort of like set up and great things are going to happen there. It's famine and he's like, nope, leave it here. So he clearly does have the idea that if something should be elevated but he doesn't like feel it, in the past he's sort of left. What I'm wondering is, with this, is it Sodom that almost changed his mind? God goes, I'm going to destroy Sodom.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, will you save some of the people? God's like, yeah, sure, I'll save the people if there are that many righteous people.
Yeah.
Will you save it for this many people? Will you save it for this many people? And God's like, look, if there's that many people, I'll save it. And the result being that there wasn't enough people. Lot just manages to escape. He loses his wife, who turns into like a salt lick. And the next thing you know, he ends up with his daughters and birthing two sort of tribes which are known to be sort of inherently evil for several generations.
Yeah.
So could it be that Sodom almost teaches Abraham that when you try and argue with God, you know, you can try, but then he knows how it's going to end up.
Now, the trouble with that story is that many of those incidents happen much later. The wife got destroyed, but the many of the nations that emanated from those liaisons happened at a much later period. So I'm not sure. I still think the point
he
is
he still slept with his daughters.
Yeah, he did. But that came about.
Later.
But I still doesn't take away the argument that he could have done. I'll take one more point, and we'll take a look at other sources. Yeah.
Well, there is something that these both do have in common.
Yes.
For the during Sodom and Gomorrah, he says, "Well, you say that if there are 50 good people." 40
yeah.
people,
yeah.
30 people, etc.
Yeah.
But he never actually says, will you save them because they are people and killing them is murder.
Mm.
So he's not against killing a few people. What he is against is mass murder.
Okay, but my point being, that's a nice, interesting,
that's
an interesting point. I like the argument. But okay, it's even worse though. By your argument, he's effectively saying he has no problem with mass murder. He's just a problem. Is there a few good people in there? Can I find them? Okay, let me make you my key examples of why I think he failed the test. And these are my key pieces of evidence. All right, number one, the angel of God. Now, we left at the last period where the knife is at the throat of his son, right? And then we say, Avraham reached out, took the sword, and it slit his son's throat. God's angel called to him from heaven and said, Avraham, Avraham, yes, do not harm the boy, do not do anything for him, for now I know that you fear God, you have not withheld your only son from him. What is significant about this part? There's something quite significant. Yes.
It's not God, it's his angel.
And it's the angel of God, exactly correct. God does not speak to him. Up until this point, God speaks to Avram, always speaks to him, never an angel. At this point, and from this point forward, God never speaks to him directly again. It's the angel of God that speaks to him. Right? Yeah.
The angel spoke to him when the three angels came.
Those were the messengers who were coming, yeah. But when
they're
God...
still angels.
They were messengers. You're right, and there's a debate. And Rambam, if you look at Maimonides, he's not comfortable with them being angels in their mystical form. He sees them as physical messengers. But besides the point, you're correct. But when God's having a direct relationship with him, it's usually God telling him in the same way. He does have that dialogue. He never has a direct dialogue with God again after this point, at this point. Once he goes forward with it, it's the angel of God, and you'll find nothing in the text which shows God directly speaking to him. My second point, the death of Sarah, which we know followed in the following parsha directly afterwards. Sarah was 127 years old. These were the years of life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Avram came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now, she died immediately after. He never spoke to his wife again. She died as a result. And many say, why did she die? The causes of her death. Well, this is because, from Rashi, the commentator on above, the telling of Sarah's death directly follows the binding of Isaac. Because where Sarah is told about the binding of Isaac, where her son has been prepared for slaughter, and was nearly not slaughtered, her soul flew from her and she died. The shock of that incident killed her. So not only did he lose his relationship with God, he loses his wife immediately after. He never gets to speak to her again. She dies. Gone. My third piece of evidence is to do with Yitzhak himself, Isaac. And it goes on, we know in the next chapter goes, Avram was old, well stricken in age, and the Lord had blessed Avram in all things. And Avram said unto his servant, who's his servant? Eliezer. It doesn't actually say Eliezer in the text. We know from Rashi and other commentaries it's Eliezer, he's his favourite servant. Anyway, the elder of his house that ruled over all that he had. Place your hand under my thigh, and I'll make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but instead you shall go to the land of my birthplace, to my kindred, and take a wife for my son, Isaac, Yitzhak. Yeah? He never has another conversation with Yitzhak after that instant. There's no recollection in the text of him speaking to his son. He sends his messenger to go and find him a wife. He doesn't say to Yitzhak any time, any conversation, I bless you, my son, a wife will be found for you. No conversation. So my point is, there is no conversation with God again. It doesn't have his wife again, she's died, and he doesn't have a conversation with his son again after that event. And on my basis, I'm arguing to you that the reason he doesn't is because he technically ticked the boxes and passed the test in the sense of doing what God said, but my point to you is he actually fouled the test on a deeper level. He should have spoken out, and because he didn't speak out, he ended up with those three losses. He lost his wife, he lost his relationship with God, and he lost his relationship with his son. Yes.
When you say speaking out, do you mean that when angel says, comes to him and says, don't slaughter him, do you mean I'm saying, no, God has told me to, I'm going to slaughter
him? No, I'm saying he shouldn't have got to the stage where he was prepared to go ahead with what God was telling him. He should have challenged God at that stage. And because he didn't, he went down in the estimation of God. He was not seen as the favoured servant of God. He was lesser down, which is why it was the angel of God rather than God directly speaking to him. He'd lost that level of prophecy as a result of him going that stage. And I would suggest to you, and from my research, what I'm finding, others have made some comment on this one, that the tests that he had were not necessarily tests that he passed. Each of those tests were challenges. The question is, would he stand up to them, or would he just go along with the voice of God? It's not denying. The issue here is not about denying the existence of God or recognising the existence of God. It's whether that in itself means you should just go along with what God's telling you. Is there a point where you should challenge and you should say, I accept you exist, I accept your commandments, but me as a human being living in a human reality should not just accept what I've been told, I should challenge that. And I suggest to you, he didn't challenge it. And I'm suggesting to you, that's why I think he failed. Yes?
A question for you. Are there any sources, I think you've just saying there are, that agree with that hypothesis?
I would say there are recent commentators who are indicating this, right? And there are some who've touched on this one. I haven't yet come across ancient commentators who are saying that. But then, to be honest with you, that doesn't in itself mean it's a wrong prognosis. But I have got found others who have made a similar comment about the issue of him perhaps having a secondary passing of this test rather than a main. Yes.
Is there some kind of parallel then between him having the courage to stand up against his father,
yes,
about the idols and that,
yeah,
but he didn't stand up against God.
Yes.
So there's the kind of, it's like he started off in a way really kind of great, and then later on,
yeah,
he kind of declined in,
yeah,
in his moral courage.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
But he wouldn't have gone against God because it says the angel says, now I know you fear God. So he wouldn't have gone against God because he would have feared God.
Yeah, I understand the point. And I think no one's disputing the fact they had this true belief in God, and he was clearly the, you know, seen as the progenitor of a whole series of nations. No one's disputing that. No one's decrying the fact that he had that closeness to God. What I am saying is, I don't think ultimately he was. I think he fouled at the ultimate point, that really he should have said, I do believe in you, I trust in you, but this is a step too far. You can't expect me to take another life in this way. That to me is not the human thing to do. Yes?
This is just being curious. As you know, that attempting to kill his brother, or
yes,
trying to, is that the only challenge or task that we know of that all of the, the rabbis would have agreed on, or any other
tasks? Well, the other tasks were, you know, clearly, again, if you want to take this principle in all its way, I mean, there were many instances whereby you don't question whether he should have challenged God over the chucking out of his wife Hagar, the chucking out of Ishmael, potentially, and when God says to him, listen to your wife, perhaps he should have said, well, no, I think it's the wrong thing to do. Why did he not stand up at those points, yeah? When he went into Avimelech and he claimed that his wife was his sister, should he have said, well, no, I'm not prepared to lie? And Avimelech, quite rightly, did say to him when he got punished, Avimelech, he says, you lied to me, you told me she was your sister. You know, I went with her, and he gets punished because he lied to him. You know, he didn't challenge, why didn't he challenge that point? Yes, yeah.
I was just going to ask, would you then characterise the rest of the story of the sort of descendants of Abraham as a story of God giving them a second chance to sort of overcome the initial flaw?
I think you're correct. I will think that. And that's one final point, because we're going to have to...
Exactly as you said, it says, do not harm God, it shows that you fear him.
Mm.
It shows that you fear him. It doesn't say, well done, you've won, you've completed the task.
No.
It just says, you fear him.
Yeah.
That's what we see from this task.
I think all the commentators would agree that he passed the test at one level, right? Mm. That he did what he was told. Okay, so he did that. But the question is, there's a higher level whereby he should have said, the higher passing would have been, actually, I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong. I disagree. And that would have been a higher level passing.
So, So the interpretation that I've heard, which takes it that Avram's on a higher level,
mm,
is that you or I would all be in that situation where we would challenge God because we wouldn't have the faith that Abraham had in God.
Yeah.
So when you're faced against killing your own son, that's something that so reviles any of us, or even committing any kind of killing act, whether it be sacrifice or not, is something that we would react so far against. So we're in a situation where, and I totally understand your precept here,
yeah,
of trying to find a reasoning that,
yeah,
saying, actually, that human instinct of saying, no, God, this isn't right,
mm,
is something that you're trying to show, and you're making, you know, a very cogent case for it. The interpretation I've heard is that Avram had such faith,
yeah,
that even at that moment, he knew that it just wouldn't be fulfilled. Yeah, and therefore, nobody else could have done that because everybody else would have had that doubt. And having that doubt, you couldn't have ever gone through with it.
Okay.
So essentially you're saying it was a double bluff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy it. I understand. Your final point, because I want to finish with the last couple of sources. Yeah.
I wanted that sacrificing a human to me is just like sacrificing an animal, because a human life is just as valid as an animal life.
Ooh.
And Abraham would have gone against God if he would have.
Oh, that's another challenge in itself. That one is about animals. I'm not sure even the rabbis would agree with you on that one, but it's an interesting point. Let me take the point. I actually say, he was given a goat in its place.
Yes,
that's correct.
Yes.
Which was sacrificed. But listen, I actually would argue that the Torah did not go through Avram because of this failure. It came generations later through Moshe Rabbeinu. Why do we say Moshe is seen as being the teacher rather than Avram our father? It says in Devarim, no other prophet like Moses has arisen in Israel who knew God face to face. And of the seventh principle of faith, of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, the belief in the primacy of the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, is seen as central. He is seen as the father of the teacher of Torah, not Abraham. And I'll finish on a final source from Rabbeinu Bachya. And this is from the 11th century, and it's from Duties of the Heart. It says as follows: if you're a person of intellect and understanding, you're obligated to use your faculties until you gain a clear and definite knowledge. In order of time, instruction based on tradition must necessarily precede knowledge obtained by the exercise of reason, since learners must rely on what they're taught before they can obtain independent knowledge. Yet, it would show a lack of willingness for anyone to rely on tradition alone, who, if they can obtain certainty by the method of rational demonstration. Everyone who has the requisite capacity is obligated to investigate with his reason whatever knowledge can be acquired and to bring evidence that which deliberate judgment would support. So I would suggest to you that the ultimate point is, I think he did fail the test. I think he passed at a lower level. Yes, he was seen as a man of God, but I don't think he was seen as appropriate to be the leader of the Jewish people in itself. That was left to Moses, or Moshe Rabbeinu. Moses is seen as the teacher. He was seen as being the more appropriate person later on, because he actually was of the right character. And I think really that's the argument I wish to make. I mean, I think I've used my sources. You can agree. Ultimately, you can disagree with me. That's fine. But at least if I've given you something to think about, then that's really I've achieved something. So you can all go back in your different walks of life and use this as a way forward. See what other people think. Okay, thank you.